Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. I am your temporary host, Jeremy Goldcorn, filling in for the jet-setting Kaiser Guo, who will send us a postcard from Prague. Today, joining us in the pop-up Chinese studios are Will Moss, PR expert and the blogger behind Image Thief, Gadi Epstein, Beijing bureau chief for Forbes magazine, and a special welcome to our new guest, Malcolm Moore, Daily Telegraph correspondent in Shanghai, who is in Beijing at the moment covering the visit of David Cameron, the UK Prime Minister, to China. But we'll start off talking about an internet subject, 360 versus Tencent, two massive Chinese internet companies having a war. What's going on? 360 is a company that provides antivirus software and malware removal services. And they have been in a feud with several other Chinese internet companies whom they accuse of putting malware on users' computers and other crimes. Some of their current rivals include Baidu and Kingsoft, but they have recently escalated a war against Tencent, who make QQ, China's biggest internet company. The war escalated about a week ago as Tencent declared that its users, all 600 million of them, could not use the antivirus software provided by 360 if they wanted to continue using QQ, Tencent's flagship chat product. The media has been all over it, and Chinese netizens have been up in arms about the war, some of them declaring faithfulness to QQ, some to Tencent, and all kinds of opinions. It's got to the point where the government has actually stepped in. There are various Ministry of Truth directives, in China Digital Times' phrase, directing China's media not to report on this subject anymore. What's going on, Will?
Well, for one thing, nobody looks good. Everybody comes out of this looking bad. Neither 360 nor Tencent seems to have thought much about what's actually good for their users. Both of them seem to have thought about playing against each other for advantage. And as near as I can tell, they're both suffering some public trust issues as a result. You were talking a moment about government attention as well. Clear on up to the Minister of Industry and Information Technology, which is the ministry that's responsible for the technology industry as a whole. The minister himself has chided both companies for uncivilized behavior and told them basically to get their act together. And really, if the minister is telling you to knock it off and get it together, maybe it's time to listen. These aren't little tiny companies. These aren't fringe players in the Chinese software industry. These are companies that are present on a huge number of Chinese desktops.
Let's put it into perspective. If you put this onto the global or the American internet, this would be Google versus Norton antivirus, basically, right?
The Norton antivirus of China has just accused the Google of China. Let's just accuse the comparable company of spying on all its users. QQ, this is the root, the accusation at the heart of the whole thing. 360, the antivirus company, the Norton of China, has accused Tencent, the most widely used instant messaging, the makers of the most
widely used. Microsoft and Google of China, let's call
it. Makers of the most widely used instant messaging platform, or operators of a huge portal and all kinds of services, has accused them of spying on users of their software. That was the root accusation.
Will, why did they do that?
I don't know. One thing that QQ hasn't done clearly, as near as I can tell, is answer the charges in an honest way with their users. Or if they have, I haven't seen it. They have gotten very angry with 360. They have said, we're not going to allow our software to run anymore on computers that are running 360. I haven't seen them come back and say anything like, here's what we actually do. Here's some disclosure about the kind of information we monitor. Here's the kind of services we're installing on your computer. I've seen them get defensive and act defensive. So I don't know why 360 did it, but QQ's response makes me wonder if maybe 360 had a point.
I think the main thing is 360 wants to sell its product, right?
The underlying thing is they see
hundreds of millions of users that they want to tap into.
They're both competing for the security business,
right?
And 360 has found an incendiary way of making a bid for that business,
right? And these may be two big companies, but clearly the Norton of China here is a much smaller player than Tencent. I mean, Tencent.
But it's not a trivial player.
It's not a trivial player at all.
Tens of millions of desktops.
Yeah, seriously, they have huge market penetration, but Tencent is, let's see, on its way to making $1.x billion of profit this year. They're growing on revenues like year after year, like 50-55% revenue growth. It is the giant of China, and obviously 360 wants to sort of kind of piggyback on that. And there is a backstory here. I think a lot of people in the internet space fear Tencent and their prowess in a number of different kind of product areas.
And they have this huge platform.
They could use it anti-competitively, certainly. And I think there's some players in the internet space that are kind of happy to see Zhou Hongyi go after Ma Huateng, kind of
the Microsoft position. I think that's true. They're a huge behemoth. They own a huge number of desktops in China. Very, very powerful and a very interesting company. I guess the question is, I can understand the logic of going after them to drive business, to draw attention to G360 and their security products. I question whether the route they've gone is the best way to do that. They've definitely gotten some PR and notoriety for themselves, but they've also alienated a lot of users, and they put themselves in a position where users are forced to pick between, you know, purveyors of legitimate software. And that's a very dangerous game for both sides to be playing right now. Microsoft has already been reported to be benefiting on the fringes of this as people punt QQ and go for MSN.
I think we should let the jet-setting Kaiser Guo inform us about some of the history of this type of dispute. A podcast from Prague about previous malware involving some of the same characters.
I'd like to warn the listeners that although this is sort of a somewhat involved explanation, it gets more and more entertaining as it goes along, as Kaiser describes this. So I think listen in.
Greetings from Prague, and thanks, guys, for keeping the ship afloat in my absence. I wanted to provide a little bit of background about this recent kerfuffle between antivirus provider 360 and Tencent. This is actually just the latest chapter in something that stretches back quite a few years. In 2006, I was a reporter for the Silicon Valley-based magazine Red Herring, and I did a story about Zhou Hongyi, the man behind 360, who was a principal in China's first malware war. Zhou Hongyi is, of course, also one of the principal antagonists in the current struggle. Zhou was the founder of a company called 3721, Sanxiaoyao, which was one of the original browser toolbars created back in the very early days of the Chinese internet. It was a way of letting people who weren't so good at pinyin, English, or the Latin alphabet enter URLs in Chinese. So if you typed in the Chinese characters Xinlang or Sohu, you would be redirected to sina.com.cn or to sohu.com. Zhou auctioned off Chinese characters and made a tidy pile of money. He later sold his company to Yahoo and became, for a time, general manager of Yahoo China. The agreed price, I've heard, was $120 million, but Zhou ended up making only about $90 million because he didn't hit all of his targets. Still, that was a hefty sum, of course. 3721 became a very important piece of Yahoo China. Jewel in the crown, really. It drove a significant amount of its search traffic. But other companies understood what a valuable piece of real estate 3721 toolbar occupied. Many other companies, the portals, Baidu, where I work, even the China Internet Network Information Center, or CNNIC, CINIC, got involved. Everyone developed these toolbars, which were intended to uninstall the other guy's toolbars and to defend against being uninstalled themselves. It very soon got to the point where it was nearly impossible, unless you were quite the accomplished technologist, to uninstall one of the numerous browser toolbars that were out there constantly infesting you. Meanwhile, the 3721 was vital to Yahoo's business. Business was faltering, and Zhou clashed badly with Yahoo management. It was clear, especially at the time that Alibaba assumed control of Yahoo, I think that was August of 2006, that Zhou's days were numbered. And so Zhou started handing out money to software engineers at Yahoo. Gifts from his own pocket, he said, which was, as he insisted, his legal right. When he left Yahoo, though, 104 Yahoo employees left with him, presumably the ones that had gotten money from him. He very quickly started up a new company called Qihu. And one of his first moves at the helm of this new business was to join forces with Kaspersky, a Russian antivirus provider that's quite popular here in China, to release a piece of free software called 360 Safe, 3720, which was designed specifically to go after 3721. In other words, it was designed to uninstall the very software that Joe had built and profited on and sold to Yahoo. And of course, he knew exactly how to take it down. Now, Jack Ma was apoplectic and threatened that Alibaba and Yahoo would not cooperate with any company that did any business with Zhou Hongyi. There were suits and countersuits that all amounted to about nothing. Joe told me when I interviewed him at the height of this warfare that he was repentant over his role as the godfather of hooligan software in China. Hooligan software, or liumang ranjian, is what Chinese people call malware. And I swear his eyes were misting over. Joe, you see, is an extremely charismatic guy, the kind of guy who has you reaching for your checkbook without knowing it while talking to you. He went quiet then for a while, though he's made plenty more enemies along the way. In fact, he's basically at war with everyone, from all the big internet sites to major software makers like Kingsoft, which is, of course, very large in antivirus here. I'm not sure what his endgame is, but you do kind of have to hand it to him. He bided his time and built up an enormous number of installations before he went after the piece of software with easily the biggest install base of anything in China, which is, of course, Tencent's QQ. I am dying to see how this one plays out.
Thank you, Kaiser. Gadi, what do you have to say about this?
This is a, I guess, Hobbesian, Machiavellian environment. And it's interesting to see how Yahoo is a part of this story. They always seem to play a sort of supporting role in any number of China kind of internet either kind of dramas or scandals. You know, right now they're going through this issue with Alibaba. They own a 39% stake in Alibaba Group, much to Jack Ma's, consternation, Jack Ma being the CEO and founder of Alibaba Group. And so he's been trying for a couple of years to buy back that stake. Yahoo and Alibaba aren't getting along. And then you have this whole, backstory with Zhou Hongyi and Yahoo. They hate each other now. Jack Ma and Pony Ma, I think, get along very well, the Alibaba and Tencent. So they're sort of on the other side of this.
This has got nasty. It has got personal. Neither company has covered itself in glory. And I think they're both going to have some work to do after all the dust has settled.
Yahoo does seem to be the company that always kind of gets the wrong end of the stick. I mean, they're the people that, whose actions result in dissidents being locked up. They're the people who kind of sell themselves to Alibaba and then kind of get sort of screwed by the deal. They never quite seem to make the right move in China.
I agree. I think the end story...
Or globally, maybe.
Well, yeah, I would say that the people holding stock in Yahoo would agree with you on globally. And I think the end of the story in China is... ultimately, this Alibaba stake has got to be sold, because I think that's going to be the precursor to any sort of acquisition of Yahoo going forward.
All right. Enough about this Chinese internet wars. Let's move on to the visit of the British Prime Minister David Cameron to Beijing. And for that, we have our specially invited senior British correspondent, Malcolm Moore, up from Shanghai. Welcome, Malcolm. I just want to start by a small and very weird episode that was reported by Bloomberg today. I read from Bloomberg's report. UK Prime Minister David Cameron resisted a request from Chinese officials yesterday to remove the poppy symbol that Britons wear every November in memory of their war dead. Poppies have been Britain's symbol of remembrance since World War I. But the flower has a different resonance in China, which fought and lost two opium wars with Britain in the 19th century. Those resulted in the UK forcing the Chinese to open their borders to trade, including the narcotic opium derived from the Asian variety of the poppy. This is absurd, isn't it?
Well, I think this is a classic clash of symbols here, Jeremy. I mean, I remember when I was a kid at school, 7, 8 years old, putting my poppy on November the 11th, which was Armistice Day, the day that war ended in Europe, and traipsing down to the memorial. And frankly, everybody in the UK wears a poppy on November the 11th. It raises money for the British Legion, who look after war vets. So, basically everybody in the country has to wear one. And there's no way that a British politician couldn't wear one.
I should point out your former colonial possessions, not America, but certainly South Africa. We used to have the same tradition when I was a schoolboy.
Well, excellent. I'm glad to hear it.
Not anymore.
Well, that's a shame, I think. And don't forget that, you know, hundreds of thousands of Chinese also died fighting the war in Europe. And the poppy, you know, is a remembrance to them as well.
Clearly, it's more of a British nationalist symbol. That said, it doesn't seem inappropriate at all for them to do this remembrance, right?
And also, everybody seems to have been remarkably civilized on both sides about the whole thing. It doesn't appear to have got particularly hot.
Well, my personal feeling about this is that it's strange that you know, the abiding image that Chinese people still have of the British is of the Opium Wars. You know, any chance to remind British people that we were involved in the Opium Wars, even if it's you know, a Chinese assistant popping up to say to the Prime Minister, hang on, you can't go into the Great Hall of the people wearing a poppy. You know, that's...
Can I ask you just to get a little deeper into this, like maybe the PR aspect of this, would it be normal for British politicians to wear the poppy on November 10th, 9th?
That's an interesting question.
Because today is November 10th when this issue came up.
I mean, actually it was last night at the Great Hall of the people.
November 9th.
An interesting question because actually back in the day we just wore it on November the 11th. But I think... You know, there's been a sort of gradual creep. I know this year as well, you know, the standard issue poppy is a small little paper poppy with a plastic stem that you buy. You used to buy it for 10p. I don't know how much it costs nowadays. I've been out of the UK too long. But you buy it for 10p, and it was very cheap. This year, you're seeing diamond and ruby poppies, you know, high-end fashion poppies. And I think there's obviously, in the way that politicians... You know, kind of see these things. Any opportunity to be seen wearing a poppy during this period.
It's the American U.S. flag. Pin.
Exactly. And we're never getting rid of that.
But here, what I find interesting about this is they could have easily come up with a way, if they had thought about this issue beforehand, and maybe they did, to both wear the poppy on November 11th and not really bring up this issue with the Chinese. But this gives them a chance to look kind of tough. It's kind of the opposite of the Obama bowing too low.
I don't know that they came out looking tough. I mean,
or just to look like, you're not caving in.
I see it as the opposite. I see it as they've turned up at the Great Hall of the People and some Chinese official has suddenly gone, what are you wearing? You know, you can't wear that. And the British said, well, no, listen, we really can't take it off. But you know, I see it that maybe, you know, again, the Chinese like to remind the British that just before they're going to meet Hu Jintao, that we were colonial oppressors, and we should bear that in mind.
Right. We can all agree it's sort of much ado about nothing and sort of just kind of amusing at this point.
Although, you know, as, you know, two Americans and a South African, we shouldn't, you know, refrain from reminding Malcolm that his country is a colonial oppressor.
One thing that I think the Americans have learned in the last few years is we are not in the strongest position on that front anymore.
I don't even know what you're talking about. America is sort of a force for good in the world. Well, that's my official position.
No,
I think if we scratch back in history, Jeremy, we've all got some bad history.
What about the other aspects of the visit? I mean, let's compare it to Obama's visit. The current UK Prime Minister, David Cameron's visit, on the top story on the Daily Telegraph's website today is father of toxic milk child jailed in China for protesting. So guy whose kid was jailed for... protesting about the toxic milk has been sent to jail while Cameron is here. We also have The Guardian, who in their comment section has a piece by Simon Jenkins titled, Only Britain Can Beg for Scraps from China and Tell Them How to Behave. Subtitled, David Cameron says he will drum up trade in China and tackle human rights. It is an exercise in bluff, concealing hypocrisy. And Malcolm, before the show, you were also complaining a little bit to me about your prime minister. Let's compare him to Obama.
Well, I think there's nothing like a visit to China to remind you that Britain is now a very small and unimportant country with very little power on the world stage. I mean, I think that's the problem. I mean, the UK, you know, the economy is moribund. You know, we're coming here with a whole bunch of British companies. They're all looking for Chinese business. You know, and David Cameron has to represent them. You know, he wants these companies to be allowed into the Chinese market.
Therefore, it's a bad time to take a steel-spined moral stand.
But on the other hand, you know, the entire British population thinks that China is a horrific police state, and he has to represent them as well. So he's got to try and delicately tread his way through this issue.
So can those things be balanced?
Well, I think they've done a masterful PR job. I mean, well, you would probably be better positioned to comment on it. But what they've done is they've managed to spin a line to all the newspapers that Cameron is taking a tough line with China. You know, they leaked excerpts from the speech last night to Beijing University, but just the bits which were talked about, you know, Cameron will confront China about political reform. And then at the same time, Cameron obviously has been as polite as possible when actually meeting with China's leaders.
Right. This is not unfamiliar. I mean, it's like the kind of clearing your throat. Oh, and by the way, I'm supposed to bring up human rights.
Exactly.
You know? Take that box. Right. Unlock the guy.
Dude, right. I've seen them play that angle in the press. I guess the question I would ask you is, you know, would you buy it?
I think people have bought it. You know, I think generally people believe what they read in the newspapers, sadly.
Due to your hard work, I have no doubt.
But I mean, I think it is that, you know, the human rights issue for me goes way beyond individual cases, right? The reason it's in Britain's interest to push this in a reasonable way. I mean, I'm not saying that he should go and say to Wen Jiabao, you must free this person or you must free that person. But the reason why it's important is because, you know, it's about rule of law. You know, the Communist Party is above the rule of law in China. And that's bad for every British person, every foreign person operating in China. It's bad for British businesses. It's bad for American businesses. If you found yourself in a court case and the Communist Party can basically tell the court what to do, that's a bad situation. If you're a British national and you got arrested in China, you know, you can't be confident of a fair trial.
However, I'd like to note the Seneca podcast still wants contracts from the Chinese government.
And, you know, we have 1 week before Kaiser returns from his jet-setting tour across Eastern Europe, in which Seneca is available for sale to the World Harmony Foundation.
And a impresario, Frank Liu.
Frank Liu, yeah.
That's right.
Well, our starting price is only $2 million US.
So if you want
Frank,
to...
call us now, care of Jeremy Goldcorn.
Yeah. Right. All right, so let's wrap up our discussion of David Cameron. You still haven't allowed me the pleasure of contrasting U.S. and U.K. visits.
Oh, please do.
Press coverage of Obama in China, very negative, said he didn't get what he needed to get on trade and he didn't make any real effort or didn't get any results in terms of human rights. Let's compare it with David Cameron. How do you think the press is going to react to David Cameron?
Well, again, it was a masterful PR operation because what they did was the embassy called in all the journalists before the trip and spun that the trip was going to be a complete waste of time. Even though it's the biggest trade mission since Lord McCartney, he of the Opium Wars, was here.
Nicely done, bringing that circle all the way around.
You know, it's huge. There are loads of business people here. But they called us in and they said, listen, you know, we're not going to sign any deals. Last week in France, $22 billion. This week, don't expect anything. It's going to be a total washout. So accordingly, all the newspapers, you know, obliged them and wrote, don't expect anything apart from some small agreement on Scotch whiskey and maybe a chance to import some pigs into China.
I don't think you want to minimize the Scotch whiskey thing.
Yeah, that's huge and enforceable.
I think by comparison, it's kind of hard to set low expectations for any presidential, U.S. presidential visit to China.
Yeah. True. And also the U.S.-China relationship is so fraught and so fetishized that I think there's no way to underplay it. There's just, there was just no way to underplay.
What you're talking about is basically skillfully playing to the UK's well-studied sense of inferiority, basically.
And then the second part of the strategy was deny journalists all access whatsoever. So any little scraps of access they got, they were incredibly grateful for and didn't really question too closely the line that was being spun, which is, of course, time-honored tradition. You know, don't get me wrong.
And I would have to say Obama, his next visit, whenever that happens, will probably go differently. I'm not saying he'll get better press, but that was kind of a different point in sort of not only China-U.S. relations, but also China relations with the world. Things have gotten a little bit worse, I would say much worse, measurably, since then in terms of public perception. So he wouldn't try the same sort of tack.
Next time they have a meeting, he'll just get his ear bent for 2 hours about quantitative easing.
Right. Well, let's go into quantitative easing for the next 20 minutes. Hello? Hello?
I'm sorry, Gandhi.
Our price just dropped.
We lost all the audience, and Frank Liu retracted his offer. So let's not. Let's talk about disease. Let's talk about the plague.
Nice comeback.
The plague. So recently there was a piece of research release that, Malcolm, you did some research on. It appears that the bubonic plague originated in China. piece of research from the University College of Cork, correct?
Well, the professor at the University College of Cork led the research, but it was, in fact, geneticists from all over the world.
Including China.
It's a genetic piece of research.
What they pretty much, they used various genetic tests.
What they did was they, and first of all, let me say this is not a nationalist issue. You know, I don't think the point of the research was to pin the blame for the Black Death on China.
But if we can,
then why not? What they did was, plague is still endemic in many countries in the world. You know, it's endemic in Africa, it's endemic in the U.S., it's endemic in China. And they took strains of the bacteria that causes the plague, which is called Yersinia pestis. And they basically sequenced all the genomes for 280 of them, and they worked out a sort of family tree that allowed them to trace back the route. And they decided the root was in China. And the Chinese plague experts that we spoke to, by the way, at the Center for Infectious Disease Control said that this was totally spurious and just hypothetical. But that's what they believe.
And it plays into the sort of well-known notions of diseases being born in China, the SARS, bird flu, the influenza of 1918.
The 1918, the great
flu. The California.
Some people believe. Now, of course, my memory of this is fading from when I covered the bird flu and SARS before that. But there's belief that southern China has sort of been the. There was the 67 flu, of course, and I would say perhaps be more spurious to suggest going further back. We wouldn't know, but. But let me do that here on this podcast. But anyways, there's this sort of notion that these diseases start in China. And it ties in, Jeremy, with what you were going to talk about, connection to this, right? Treatment.
But let's look at the diseases first. I mean, it's not unnatural. None of us are medical scientists. But it doesn't seem to me illogical that China would be the origin of a lot of diseases. You have the world's biggest, most concentrated population, right, or at least a highly concentrated population. You have people who have been living in proximity to animals, birds and pigs, goats.
Intensively
for thousands of years. You have agricultural practices where you'll have a family living on top and among the animals that they keep.
And a nation that at least at various points in its history had, you know, well-established trade routes, export, exploration.
In the past and once again now, you have a nation that is in daily contact with four corners of the globe.
But the date range they gave for the origins of the bubonic plague, they were quite wide, but basically at least 2,600 years ago. So if we look at the world 2,600 years ago, you know, China was probably a lot more civilized than anywhere
I'm sure,
else.
I'm certain that they were manipulating the renminbi back then.
the interesting thing I thought is that I was speaking to Mark Ackman, the professor who led the research, and I said, do you have any records of plague outbreaks in China at around about the same time that the Black Death was wiping out a third of Europe's population? And he said, yeah, well, I've got this book that was published in 1930, and it's a how to deal with bubonic plague handbook. And he said that inside it, they've got detailed records of going back all the way through the different dynasties of when the plague outbreaks happened and where they were. So then I spoke to the Chinese experts, and I said, do you have any history of plague outbreaks in China? And they said, absolutely not. This is all conjecture. We don't have any outbreaks, any records post the 19th century. So we've got no idea what happened in the 14th, 13th centuries.
I have heard debate about whether the plague traveled the Silk Road, back then, and I don't know the definitive scholarship. Do we have anybody who wants to pretend to?
He said that he didn't know whether the Black Death in Europe came down the Silk Road, because there is some speculation linking the two.
Right.
But that plague, the Silk Road was a plague route after that.
Okay.
And it surprises me, knowing how much there have been issues about outbreaks of disease originating in China in contemporary times, it nevertheless surprises me that something that's really a matter of ancient historical record would still seem to arouse such sensitivities.
Yes, I mean, you know, we ran into that classic thing when you're working as a journalist in China, which is that everybody thinks that you're trying to do some sort of anti-China article with every question that you ask.
Were you?
No.
I'm just checking.
This time, no.
Very good interrogation, Will.
Thank you.
Yeah, we haven't noticed Malcolm selling any opium since he arrived in the pop-up Chinese studio.
He's not wearing a poppy at this time either.
You know, if they raise the poppy thing, maybe David Cameron could just bring up the plague.
You know, to bring out the plague.
I was feeling guilty for not wearing a poppy. My question is, where did David Cameron get his poppy? I mean, did he bring it with him? How did he transport it? Because they get crushed very easily.
And is that in contravention of maybe he was wearing China's one of the import export laws? Okay, let's look at treatment. Something that's been going on in the Chinese media this week that I think is pretty interesting is there's been a spate of stories about antibiotics and the rampant overuse of them in China. And this has come about basically because of a government initiative looking to control the rampant over-prescription of antibiotics. And if you've been to a Chinese hospital for any kind of complaint, you've probably had the experience of the doctor saying to you, well, I don't really know what's wrong with you, but why don't you sit in this chair and we'll stick a drip in your arm and we'll, like, pump you full of 100 cc's of powerful antibiotic. That'll cure whatever the fuck you've got.
I haven't been on the receiving end of this myself, but I can report from experience that the exact same treatment strategy is employed with pets as well.
It is indeed. It's the drip first. And, you know, the drip isn't always antibiotics.
Rehydrating is very important.
It could be rehydrating. Could just be basically salt water that they're putting into you. Could be Chinese medicine. But by far and away, the most common drip that you'll get if you go with, you know, symptoms of any kind to a Chinese hospital is antibiotics, a big dose.
And right. It's not just prescriptions either. I mean, the plural of anecdote is not data, but my wife bought amoxicillin over the counter earlier this week at our local pharmacy, just went in and asked for it, and they gave it to her. It's just not that hard to get here.
Right. It's a very serious issue everywhere, though. I mean, this is not just China. I mean, there's a global body that is trying to limit the use of antibiotics, you know, and then in the UK we've had all these hospital bug scares. I think in New York there have been a few as well.
It is a global problem, but in Western Europe, in the United States, and even in places like South Africa and Zambia, to get an antibiotic takes a bit of doing. You have to get a proper doctor's prescription, or you have to really seek out a back alley cure. Whereas in China, you don't. I mean, even in the capital, almost any pharmacy will sell you any kind of antibiotic.
Right, and we have to understand the financial incentives built into the Chinese medical system, where kickbacks and there's all sorts of profit motives to prescribing it or giving antibiotics to patients. It's a key source of revenue for hospitals, for the doctors who give the drugs. I mean, obviously, American medical system has its own kind of distorted incentives as well. But as you said, there are some backstops. It's tougher to get antibiotics.
There's a very strong link, I think, in the Chinese mind between sickness and injections. You know, antibiotics, firstly, are totally useless against viruses, right? They're only for bacteria-caused diseases. But if you get a cold or something, you will get an injection. If you have a headache, you'll get an injection. And it's usually an antibiotic injection. I mean, there's, for some reason, that you know, the psyche has decided that Western medicine involves being injected with something.
See, if they'd done their homework, they'd know that Western medicine actually involves sitting in the waiting room for countless hours.
Oh, but they do that here as well, especially
really?
If you don't have money in your pocket.
They've arrived. It's modern here.
But it's you know, it's not just that it doesn't work, because, I mean, you know, if you have a viral infection, obviously antibiotics which kill bacteria are not going to help you. But many people have, you know, even if they have a viral infection, they may also have some kind of low-grade bacterial infection. And if you give somebody a big dose of antibiotics, if they've got anything wrong with them that is making them feel discomfort that's caused by bacteria, they will feel better immediately. So there is a patient demand for this. I mean, it's not just...
And that's true of Western patients as well, for sure.
That is true of Western patients, but it tends to be in most Western countries that the doctors are a little bit more restrained in the prescription.
I think that may very well be true. The experience I was going to relay was actually Singapore, where I lived for many years before I came to China, which was a bit similar to here in that antibiotics were very widely prescribed. Singapore has a neighborhood clinic system. There's like thousands of little neighborhood clinics. And very common to come out of visits to those clinics with antibiotic prescriptions. And that was my experience when I lived there and used to go to those clinics for whatever ailed me. And so it's not just a Chinese issue. I don't know how that relates to the West because I could never afford to seek medical care there. But it certainly seems to be at least an Asian issue.
But it seems to me that judging from the Chinese language commentary on this issue, it's going to be very difficult to act on it because the China Daily story didn't really reflect it. But in some of the Chinese language commentary, there was talk about how antibiotic sales account for about 30% of the revenues of all medicine sales in China. So hospitals, which don't really get subsidized by the government anymore, are also making a big chunk of their revenue, maybe 30% of their revenue from selling antibiotics or prescribing antibiotics. And this means that there is not any economic incentive for the hospitals and doctors to stop prescribing this. What is to be done?
Healthcare reform.
Which that, is
no the ever you know the specter of healthcare reform
in every
seems
country
always to be around the corner.
That's just crazy talk.
Yeah, that's crazy. In every country on the planet, that's crazy talk. Are you some kind of socialist?
I've been waiting for this Chinese healthcare reform bill since I got to China. You know, when's it going to come?
Yeah, that's going to be a tough one for them. I really think that the economic incentives are they're just as long as the economic incentives are there, they're never going to solve that problem. Even if they regulate against it, I just you know. Unless they really enforce it. And if they do that, then their hospitals are going to go out of business, are going to look for some other kind of revenue source that's going to cause.
It's definitely going to take a long time. Right now, you still have, I mean, one of the reasons that those incentives are powerful is doctors still make very little money unless, you know, they have the add-ons, you know, the money that you get for, you know, certain, you know, surgeries, medical procedures, you know, CAT scans or whatever, all the kind of add-ons that come with doing those. All the add-on money that comes with providing those services, and that includes antibiotics. And it'll take years for that to sort of slowly change. And I think healthcare reform, funding, you know, more funding for rural healthcare, you know, more insurance, hopefully will actually, you know, help in the long term to kind of standardize the system. But it's going to take years.
On this note, a soft power own goal for China. Let's end this week's Cynical Podcast. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for participating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.